Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of July 10th, 2017. My name again is Tom Charlone. I'm the Energy Group practice leader at Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, resident in our firm's Houston, Texas office. Late last week, the Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, signed an order that seeks to tamp down on delays in the permitting of federal land for oil and gas exploration and production activities. As of January 31st of this year, there was a backlog of over 2,800 applications for drilling permits on federal leases. In a telephonic press conference, Secretary Zinke did not mince words when he noted that, quote, "There's a reason why our energy revolution from 2008 forward has been primarily on private lands and state lands and not federal lands. We have been particularly, I think, punitive in some ways." Some highlights from the Department of the Interior's order include the following. Reviews of applications for drilling permits now must be completed within 30 days. Last year, by contrast, the average processing time was a staggering 257 days. The Bureau of Land Management will, going forward, be required to conduct quarterly lease sales. And finally, the preparation of a status report by department staff due to the secretary's office within just 45 days that will include an action plan for, quote, "improving the federal onshore oil and gas leasing program." The decision to cut through delays and other red tape was, of course, greeted with enthusiasm from the industry. Echoing those sentiments was Congressman Rob Bishop, the chairman of the House Committee on Natural Resources, who emphasized that the Republican-controlled House would support Secretary Zinke's initiatives with new laws, if that's what it takes. Quote, "Secretary Zinke's commitment to foster regulatory certainty and unleash our energy potential is a welcome shift in priorities at Interior. We will be working in close coordination with the Secretary to provide the Department with the statutory tools to ensure that responsible energy development on federal lands is no longer held hostage to intransigent bureaucracy and ludicrous permitting delays." Unsurprisingly, the Department of the Interior's aggressive measures were met with venom from environmental activist groups. Neda Culver, for example, the senior policy director at the Wilderness Society, has been quoted as saying that the oil and gas industry has been sitting on thousands of approved permits on their millions of acres of leased land for years now. The real problem here is this administration's obsession with selling out more of our public lands to the oil and gas industry at the expense of the American people. Before we all get too excited, however, don't look for all of these long overdue changes to arrive immediately. As Secretary Zinke himself cautioned on the heels of the department's press release announcing the new order, quote, "This is not going to be done overnight." Increasingly, class actions are, for all intents and purposes, won or lost at the certification stage. After all, if a class is certified, especially under the heightened standards for class treatment that have been articulated by the United States Supreme Court in recent years, the exposure for defendants in the vast majority of cases is simply too great to risk a jury trial on the merits. This is, of course, why lucrative settlements often follow so closely on the heels of successful motions for class certification. By and large, class certification motions will rise or fall based on whether the representative plaintiffs can demonstrate commonality to the trial court's satisfaction. At the risk of oversimplifying what can sometimes be a highly nuanced concept, commonality exists when there is a critical mass of factual and legal issues that are generally constant across the entire class. Commonality is closely related to to and often confused with the further requirement of predominance, which turns on this slightly different question. Even assuming there is a nucleus of common questions of law and fact shared by most class members, do they sufficiently outweigh the factual and legal wrinkles that are unique to individual members of the class? Both commonality and predominance are codified in Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and, without exception, in all of its state law equivalents. All of these dynamics were recently on display when, according to an appeal filed by Devon Energy in the Fifth Circuit, a Texas federal judge ran afoul of the commonality and predominance requirements by certifying a class of natural gas royalty owners who alleged that the company had for many years shortchanged them on royalty payments by failing to obtain the best available market prices for their gas. According to Devon's appeal brief, quote, "If it is allowed to stand, the certification order will compel Devon to face the fundamental unfairness of attempting to defend thousands of disparate individual claims in a single trial." On the surface, at least to a casual observer, it looked as though the trial court had done what it was obligated to do under the Supreme Court's seminal decision in Walmart Stores, Inc. v. Dukes. Namely, District Judge Edward Kincaid determined that the putative class representatives had isolated no fewer than two questions of class-wide applicability. The problem, however, as was aptly observed by the Texas Oil and Gas Association in an amicus brief, was that the court stopped its analysis too soon. In particular, it did not, quote, "take the additional step of comparing those class-wide questions to the method by which, under Texas law, plaintiffs must prove breach of an implied covenant to market." Put another way, even crediting that the questions identified by the plaintiffs have class-wide applicability, the answers to the questions would not nearly dispose of the class claims. The questions, however common they might be, are ultimately red herrings that do nothing to meaningfully advance the plaintiff's burden of proof. Identifying a similar flaw in logic in another royalty underpayment case, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in EQ2 Production Company v. Adair, reprimanded, quote, "the district court for placing an inordinate emphasis on the sheer number of uniform practices without considering whether those practices are relevant to assessing the defendant's ultimate liability." The Texas Oil and Gas Association's amicus brief perhaps put it best when it explained that, quote, "in short, it is abundantly clear that Rule 23 requires putative class representatives to do more than propose a class-wide common question. They must also show that, under the applicable substantive law, the answer to that question will further their burden of proof. Because their common questions are irrelevant to their burden of proof under Texas law, the class representatives failed to meet this burden." The lesson learned here should be obvious. Before engaging in a debate over whether a fact or a legal principle is common to the class, or whether it predominates over individual issues, be sure to first ask these fundamental threshold questions. So what? Why do we care? Does this even matter? If the answer is no, the class representatives need to move on to greener pastures, if there are any. As obvious as this may seem, it is surprising just how often capable defense counsel allow themselves to get drawn into commonality and predominance arguments about matters that are, in the final analysis, either irrelevant or ancillary to the core matters with respect to which the plaintiffs bear the burden of proof. The case is Seligson v. Devon Energy Production, LP, number 17-10320, currently pending in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.